KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The country's most senior defense officials shared details of a strike in Yemen on a private messaging app. How'd that happen? Is that an example of a lack of experience in this administration? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Russia stands to gain a lot from a closer relationship with the U.S., more trade to help its economy, more influence around the world. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. But are there ways in which the U.S. would benefit as well? Also, how the U.S. looks to an interested outsider in China, and a New Year's celebration in Syria after years of repression. It's Tuesday, March 25th. 30 years ago today, WikiWikiWeb launched. Wiki, the Hawaiian word for quick, now also means websites that are edited by users. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The White House says President Trump retains confidence in National Security Advisor Mike Waltz. This is after journalist Jeffrey Goldberg reported Waltz recently included him on a text chain on a secure message app. Goldberg says top Trump officials discussed impending U.S. military attacks on Yemen, and he says they went over specific information that could have harmed U.S. troops. Colorado Democratic Congressman Jason Crow was infuriated.
The idea that they would be talking about war plans and highly classified, very top secret information over a privately owned public system is shocking, to say the least, and put our troops at great risk.
Some Republican lawmakers have downplayed the seriousness of the incident, including Texas Senator Ted Cruz.
This was obviously a mess to add a reporter to this signal chain, and I feel confident it's not something that will happen again.
The White House press secretary claims that no classified material was sent to the text. That is not what Goldberg reported, and the White House National Security Council says those texts appear authentic. Stocks opened lower this morning after a big rally on Monday. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped about 70 points in early trading.
All the major stock indexes jumped on Monday on hopes President Trump's trade war will prove less damaging than feared. Trump says some countries may get a pass from his tariff threats. Detailed plans for reciprocal tariffs are set to be released next week. Home builders are warning Trump's tariffs could drive up construction costs, pushing the already high cost of new housing even higher. Stock in KB Homes fell after the builder lowered its sales forecast for the year. Gasoline prices are inching up as refineries make the switch to more expensive summer blends of gas. AAA says the average price of the pump for regular fuel is about $3.14 a gallon. That's up 6 cents from a week ago, but still cheaper than this time last year. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
More than 15,600 children have been killed in Gaza by Israeli airstrikes and direct fire. That's according to the latest data released by Gaza's health ministry. NPR's Aya Betrari has more on the war's toll on Palestinian children.
Israeli airstrikes over the past week have pushed the death toll in Gaza past 50,000 people killed in the war, according to Gaza's health ministry. Israel says among those killed are also thousands of militants. But in a newly detailed list naming the dead, the health ministry notes that children alone make up 31% of all those killed by Israeli fire in Gaza. The single-spaced list naming Palestinians killed in the war runs more than 1,500 pages long. Just the first 27 pages are the names of more than 800 babies under a year old killed in Gaza. The health ministry notes nearly 34,000 other children have been wounded, many with amputations. Aya Beltraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
This is NPR. Former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee has a Senate confirmation hearing today. He's President Trump's nominee to be ambassador to Israel. Huckabee is a longtime supporter of Israel and a well-known evangelical Christian. He has spoken favorably of several of Israel's views. One of them includes the potential Israeli annexation of Palestinian territory. That would contradict long-standing U.S. policy and would be opposed by other nations. Telehealth employees at the Department of Veterans Affairs are being summoned back into the office to work. Clinicians say this change in policy could compromise care for veterans. And NPR's Katie Riddle has more.
Doctors and therapists say there is just not enough space at VA facilities for them to work. Many were hired as telehealth employees. Now, many will still be doing telehealth, but from one shared space. H is one such provider. She has to be identified by only her initial for fear of losing her job. She says this arrangement could violate health privacy laws.
It is very unclear how we could continue to deliver treatment because multiple people cannot be in one office trying to do treatment all at the same time.
The VA said in a response that these concerns were, quote, nonsensical and promised to continue care for veterans. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
In South Korea, multiple wildfires continue to burn in southern provinces. Cultural buildings are under threat. A Buddhist temple that is more than 1,000 years old has burned down. Treasures inside the temple were relocated ahead of the flames. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. In a few minutes, we will ask whether Russia and the U.S. would benefit from closer ties, and if so, how. But first...
In an extraordinary security breach, the country's most senior security officials created a group chat on a messaging app to discuss U.S. airstrikes on Yemen.
Now, two important points about this. First, the group chat was on that commercial messaging app, Signal, not a secure U.S. government network. And second, the group included a journalist, Jeffrey Goldberg, editor of The Atlantic magazine, apparently by accident.
For more, we're joined by NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie. Hey, Greg.
Good morning, Layla.
Okay, so, I mean, how did this happen?
Well, the editor of The Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg, said he got a notice on the messaging app Signal on March 11th, inviting him to join a group chat regarding the Houthis in Yemen. Now, the invitation came from the National Security Advisor, Mike Waltz, and included all the top national security officials, including Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. Now, Goldberg initially thought this was some sort of hoax. Someone was trying to entrap him. But over the next few days, the text increasingly looked to be genuine, with details about U.S. plans to bomb the Houthis in Yemen. Goldberg spoke to All Things Considered yesterday about what then happened on March 15th.
I'm sitting in my car in a parking lot in a supermarket at 11:44 a.m. Eastern, and I get this war plan from Pete Hegseth.
And so 2 hours later, the U.S. bombing begins in Yemen, and Goldberg realizes this is no hoax. These U.S. airstrikes are real, and they're still ongoing. And Hegseth yesterday questioned the credibility of Goldberg, but the National Security Council put out a statement saying the material appeared to be authentic.
I mean, it's pretty remarkable. And Democrats have been highly critical of Trump's national security team, saying it lacked experience. Is this an example of that supposed lack of experience?
Well, Layla, certainly seems so, and they certainly should have known better. Hegseth often talks about his military experience, as does Waltz, and rest assured they were never told as soldiers to share military operations in advance on their preferred messaging app and to include emojis, as Waltz apparently did with a clenched fist, a flag, and a fire emoji. And this group also included the nation's top two intelligence officials, CIA Director John Ratcliffe and Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard. Now, those agencies are absolutely fanatical about secure communications, yet based on Goldberg's account, no senior national security official raised concerns about sharing war plans on Signal.
And how do national security officials normally communicate when discussing sensitive military operations?
Well, those officials are supposed to use a SCIF, which stands for Sensitive Compartmented Information Facility. These secure rooms are built to discuss classified information. You can't take a phone into these rooms. You can't take documents out. And all of these top-ranking national security officials have SCIFs at their offices and at their homes.
I mean, makes sense in principle, but how does it work in reality? Senior national security officials are often traveling for work. Their job doesn't end when the weekend comes. Is this practical?
Well, it can be very impractical, but that's how it's supposed to be done. These airstrikes against the Houthis in Yemen began on a Saturday afternoon, so officials may not have been near a SCIF, but it doesn't mean they should be discussing the launch of a major U.S. military operation in real time on their phones on a commercial messaging app.
NPR's Greg Myrie. Thank you, Greg.
Sure thing, Layla.
In its first months in office, the Trump administration is breaking with decades of U.S. policy toward Russia. The president and other members of his administration have talked about economic and geopolitical deals and opportunities in Russia. So what does Russia want out of this relationship? And is there anything the U.S. could gain? For some answers, we've called Elena Rybakova. She is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. That's here in Washington, D.C. And it's a nonpartisan think tank focused on strategies for global economic development. Good morning, Ms. Rybakova. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So how would you characterize the economic relationship between the U.S. and Russia now?
Well, it is a very harsh reality of almost no relationship. The trade between Russia at the moment is about $3.5 billion per year. It is a tiny amount. It used to be closer to 20, and Russia used to have a deficit, by the way, in terms of trade with the U.S. But the relationship is very difficult. However, we have seen the current administration wants to have a restart. It is not the first restart between the U.S. and Russia in terms of warming up of the relationship.
So what would it mean for Russia if it could trade more with the U.S.?
For Russia, the most significant objective is to have the approval of the United States for it to do what it needs to do in its sphere of influence. Russia wants to be acknowledged by the U.S. as a global power in this multipolar world. And the most significant economic benefit it could get is to have sanctions lifted. And that's what we have seen Russia lobby heavily already with the current administration.
So that would not mean more trade with the U.S. It would likely mean more trade with Europe and other parts of the world. Is that right?
Absolutely. You're going straight to the point. For Russia, Europe is used to be the most important partner. And Russia exports, let's not forget, mostly natural resources. 60% of Russia's exports is oil and gas, and then another 25 or so metals and mining and other natural resources, basically almost entirely natural resources. And a big chunk of that it used to send to Europe, particularly energy. Europe bought more than 40% of Russia's energy. While for oil, Russia could divert away to China and India after the war started, this time around with Ukraine. But for gas, it is struggling. You need to have a very expensive pipeline, and China is not interested in financing it. So yes, for Russia, most importantly, it's to regain the relationship with Europe. And it's hoping that the U.S. will help push down on Europe in a way to restart the relationship, or at very least will lift sanctions which will allow Russia to restart that relationship.
So I do want to get to the sort of the broader geopolitical question, but just if I could just ask you about the sort of the narrow question, because this administration seems very focused on that. Is there a specific U.S. economic interest in normalizing or at least warming relationships with Russia?
Narrowly focused on macroeconomics, I fail to see that because the trade used to be very small. It used to be always in deficit and was not. This current administration is not happy about countries with trade deficits with the U.S. Russia exported some commodities to the U.S., oil products, especially when there were issues, say, with Venezuela. But then it's imported most of everything else. Maybe it will be car imports, semiconductors, you know, and other any more complicated products. So it's hard to see what would be specific specific macroeconomic benefits for the U.S.
So what would be the benefit to the U.S.? Because it seems very clear that this administration, at least President Trump in particular, seems to have a keen desire to normalize relations with Russia. So what would be the benefit?
Judging from the statement from the administration, I think the key benefit they see, it would allow President Trump to have the deal where there would be either ceasefire or maybe hopefully more permanent truce or peace deal in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So that to me seems to be more broader geopolitical objective rather than any specific macroeconomic benefit to the U.S. from trade with relatively small country, especially when U.S. is actually also an oil producer, and not only a producer, and also potentially an exporter of oil and gas. Let's not forget that U.S. and Russia are in direct competition in terms of selling, for example, LNG to Europe.
Exactly. So before we let you go, we only have a couple of seconds left here. So I am curious about what you see as the opportunity for warming. What might we be looking for to see whether there is actual progress here? As you mentioned earlier at the beginning of our conversation, there have been numerous kind of resets and setbacks in this relationship over the last decades. So what might we be looking for to see if there's an actual change?
I would see what Russia has to gain from it. Russia wants to have sanctions lifted. So if we hear anything about the financial sanctions being lifted or the threat of secondary sanctions being removed, I think that is the key indicator. I think the truth is unlikely to happen soon.
That is Alina Rybakova. She's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. That's a nonpartisan think tank here in Washington, D.C. Ms. Rybakova, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Texas is moving closer to requiring the Ten Commandments in public schools and allowing for school prayer. Other states are considering similar bills after a 2022 Supreme Court ruling that appeared to allow for more religion in public schools. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider reports.
Early last week, the Texas State Senate passed a bill to allow for prayer and Bible readings in public schools. The next day, it passed another bill to require every public school classroom in the state to display the Ten Commandments.
Our kids are crying out for moral clarity, crying out for it.
Republican State Senator Phil King, who represents a district west of Fort Worth, authored the Ten Commandments bill.
And I think it's so important for them to walk in and see something that has been part of our tradition and been part of our history for as far back as they'll read, almost as far back as they'll read in studying world history.
Democratic State Senator Sarah Eckhart of Austin called the bill unconstitutional.
Politics masquerading as faith is the evil the separation between church and state is designed to prevent. To ensure religious freedom for all, we must never establish a state-sanctioned religion. And that is what this bill does.
A Louisiana Ten Commandments law passed last year has been temporarily blocked by a federal judge over its constitutionality. Over a dozen states are considering bills this year, but some have stalled so far in Montana, Georgia, and the Dakotas. Some lawmakers were concerned about potential court challenges. But support among Texas lawmakers for these bills seems strong. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, a Republican, made his stance clear while welcoming the Senate's chaplain of the day.
Yesterday, we passed a bill on this floor, bipartisan, to put prayer back in public school. And later today, we will pass a bill to put the Ten Commandments in our schools. Thank you for a lifetime of serving the Lord. This is a Christ-centered legislative body.
Democratic senators argue that there are at least hundreds of thousands of Texans who don't consider themselves Christian. But amendments to post sacred texts of other faiths in public schools failed. The Ten Commandments and prayer bills are now under consideration in the Texas House of Representatives. For NPR News, I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, veteran reporters Annie Carney and Luke Broadwater share an insider's look at a dysfunctional Congress. The body elected in 2022 passed fewer bills than any Congress since the Great Depression, instead engaging in partisan infighting, petty feuds, and occasionally physical threats. Their book is called Madhouse. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting The Penguin Lessons, a new comedy starring Steve Coogan as a teacher whose life is upended after he rescues a penguin from an oil-slicked beach, starts Friday in theaters. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. From Workday, Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Beijing. In China last year, we met a Chinese scholar who studies the United States. Da Wei developed some ideas of why America has succeeded as a country.
Obviously, U.S. have a quite matured political system, which ran for more than 200 years.
The Chinese scholar said the U.S. gained from a stable political system, strong regulations, lots of immigrants. Since we spoke last year, a new U.S. administration has taken office, so we met Da Wei again this week. And it was a chance to see how America looks to an outsider. He said to meet us at a tea house.
Yeah, good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you. Thank you for coming over.
Thank you.
He rushed in wearing a blue blazer, dressed to teach a class that day at Tsinghua University.
What kind of tea did we order?
Green tea,
Dragon Well tea, which is best when harvested before April 5th.
Anyway, the tea after that, after April 5th, will be less expensive.
So this is prime tea season.
Yeah, exactly.
The server poured into tiny cups. I just want to say, this looks like just hot water almost, there's so much flavor to it.
Yeah, so if you make it at home, you put the tea leaves in this kind of a glass, you can see the tea leaves, you know.
Yeah, they float up.
Yeah, flow up and down, so it's beautiful. Mm. It's kind of philosophical, I will say. You can try to read the tea leaves.
He tried to read the tea leaves about the United States. He's followed the Trump administration's firing of federal workers and dismantling of some agencies. He's traveled often to Washington and knows many people there.
I live in the think tank world and also government world. Some of them left their office or lost their job.
Oh, you know people who've been fired
in the United States? Yeah,
okay.
And from this personal level, I feel sad or bad about what is happening in the United States. Having said that, I don't want to be too critical to Trump administration, just from this personal level. As a scholar, I try to be neutral. I think there is something big happening in the U.S. It could be bad, it could be good.
He says modern forms of government rose with the Industrial Revolution. Now technology is changing, and government may change too. This is what he thinks about when watching a billionaire tech bro promising to move fast and break things alongside a president who seems to make hourly pronouncements on social media.
So I will say this is very revolutionary.
Da Wei says some of his American friends compare this to a different revolution, China's Cultural Revolution in the 1960s and 70s.
Cultural Revolution is basically the most chaotic period of modern China history.
China's leader, Mao Zedong, encouraged supporters to root out elites and intellectuals suspected of being a kind of deep state. Radical groups harassed or attacked people at businesses and universities.
That's organized and mobilized by Chairman Mao himself and also his political allies.
I just want to say this out loud. There's a charismatic leader who, for his own purposes, gets ordinary people to get out there and attack the intellectuals and the elites.
Smash the establishment.
And the universities.
Government officials.
And supposed
closet capitalists in this communist society.
But I have to say, what is happening in the U.S. is still far from the Cultural Revolution. It's maybe 1 or 2% of the, but you can sense that smell, the populist sentiments. You know, basically everything the people have correct common sense is good. So those sophisticated thoughts are something bad.
In the Cultural Revolution, universities were shut down, the professors sent to work in the fields, and business owners were forced to surrender their homes. Dawei says he doesn't want to take this analogy too far.
I'm still confident to some institutions and the laws, rule of law of the U.S. So I don't think the situation could become so bad, but a chaotic populist political movement, I think, yeah, it's alike.
And Dawei says Trump's movement has devastated parts of the U.S. government that gave the U.S. an advantage in its competition with his country, China. The administration moved to shut down Voice of America and other broadcasters like Radio Free Asia.
So the first reaction was, oh, it's so sad, because when we were in college, we learned English through Voice of America. Voice of America have a special English program. It spoke very slowly.
They were famous for this.
Yeah. So we learn English through that. I still remember, you know, when I was a freshman in college, for the first time I listened to the Voice of America special English.
He says he heard news that Chinese media didn't cover. Dawei acknowledges that in recent years, VOA was less important as the internet spread. But he says another agency mattered more, the foreign aid agency USAID, which spread American influence in the developing world.
I think it's important, and also it's part of so-called competition between China and the U.S.
I'm thinking of a soccer term, own goal, where you score for the other team accidentally. Are foreign policy specialists here looking at the Trump administration moves as an own goal?
You can say that. You can say that. To be honest, I think the majority view here is this is in China's interest.
He says it would also be in China's interest for the U.S. to lose its alliances with European nations or South Korea or Japan.
The alliances of the U.S. is, we believe also, it's a important source, one of the most important sources of the U.S. strength.
I noticed a news item in the South China Morning Post, a famous newspaper out of Hong Kong, and they noted that the Chinese government, the foreign minister, in recent days had a meeting with officials from Japan and South Korea, longtime U.S. allies, and said, in this time of chaos, you U.S. allies need to be closer with us, China.
Yes, I think I don't want to give our listener an impression that China tried to, you know, drag away U.S. allies. For China, it's a long time goal to have good relations with Japan and Korea. These two countries are our neighbors and also very, you know, important economies.
China would want that regardless.
Of course. You can say China is utilizing this opportunity. You can also say China just doing China has done in past two decades, but now with smaller resistance. This is what is happening here.
Dawei, the Chinese scholar, finished his tea and hurried off to teach his class. He'd offered a view of the news from the United States as it looks from a Beijing tea house. This is NPR News.
The threat of a massive earthquake hangs over the Pacific Northwest, and no one knows when it could strike. For instance, you could be massively pregnant and crib shopping at IKEA.
I wrote this book because I was starting to crack, living with the fear of this.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, the debut novel Tilt by author Emma Patti on All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump tells NBC News an aide to National Security Advisor Mike Waltz was responsible for adding a journalist from The Atlantic to a group text about plans by the U.S. military to attack Houthi rebels in Yemen. The Atlantic's editor-in-chief says he was included on the March 15 text on a group messaging app and at first thought it was a hoax. NPR's Dieter Walsh has more.
The Atlantic's Jeffrey Goldberg reported that he was inadvertently added to a text chain on Signal with Vice President J.D. Vance, Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth, and Mike Walls, the president's national security advisor, and other officials discussing plans for airstrikes against the Houthis in Yemen. Senate Majority Leader John Thune said the incident needed to be investigated.
We're just finding out about it, but obviously, yeah, we got to run it to the ground and figure out what went on there.
Top Democrats denounced the breach of classified information and called for congressional probes. But House Speaker Mike Johnson downplayed the episode, saying the administration was looking into it and would fix it. Senate Armed Services Chairman Roger Wicker told reporters he planned to hold a hearing. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, the Capitol.
White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt says no classified material was included on that thread. This is NPR News from Washington. Justices on Brazil's Supreme Court are examining whether the country's former president, Jair Bolsonaro, should stand trial on charges of attempting a coup. It followed his election loss in 2022. Here's NPR's Carrie Kahn.
Brazil's attorney general outlined coup plans, which he says were orchestrated with the former far-right president's full support. Among them, a plot to poison the current president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, and kill one of the justices. If the justices accept the indictment, a criminal trial would begin. If found guilty, Bolsonaro could face decades in prison. Bolsonaro told thousands of supporters at a rally earlier this month that he's innocent. Bolsonaro's congressional allies want to pass an amnesty bill for him and defendants convicted in the ransacking of the Brasilia capital in 2023, similar to the pardons President Trump gave to hundreds convicted in the January 6th D.C. Capitol attack. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
A former interpreter for Major League Baseball star Shohei Ohtani is having the start of his nearly five-year prison sentence delayed. It was supposed to begin yesterday for bank and tax fraud over the theft of nearly $17 million from Ohtani's bank account. Federal prosecutors did not say why Ippei Mizuhara's surrender date was postponed. Ohtani is preparing for the 2025 season with the L.A. Dodgers. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Good morning. A federal appeals court in Washington, D.C. is weighing whether to allow the White House to quickly deport alleged members of a Venezuelan gang under a rarely used wartime authority.
It is the latest episode in a broader legal debate about the Alien Enemies Act. And last night, the Trump administration said it is invoking the state secrets privilege in a standoff with another federal judge over deportation flights that may have defied his orders.
NPR's Joel Rose has been following that debate, and he joins us now. Good morning, Joel.
Hey, Leila.
Okay, so this case has been moving pretty quickly. Remind us, what was the appeals court considering at the hearing Monday?
This is a three-judge panel from the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and it was hearing an appeal from the Trump administration of a lower court's ruling. The district court judge in that case has temporarily blocked the administration from deporting anyone under the Alien Enemies Act, which has only been used three times in U.S. history, all when the country was actively at war. The Trump administration argues it should apply here as well because of the threat posed by the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua, which the administration has designated as a foreign terrorist organization. In an order yesterday, the judge reaffirmed his temporary restraining order on the grounds that these Venezuelan migrants have not gotten due process, had no meaningful chance to argue that they are not members of this notorious gang.
And what happened in the appeals court hearing Monday?
One appeals court judge in particular seemed also very concerned about these due process questions. Judge Patricia Millett, who was appointed by Barack Obama. This law was used most recently during World War II, and even then, Millett said, detained Germans had a chance to fight their deportations, unlike these Venezuelans today.
There were plane loads of people. There were no procedures in place to notify people. Nazis got better treatment under the Alien Enemy Act than has happened here.
You know, the Justice Department's lawyer disputed the Nazi analogy and said that some of these Venezuelan men have, in fact, been able to fight their removal. But Judge Millett questioned whether the other 200 migrants who were deported had any chance to do that. She said, we don't have any record of whether these people were gang members or victims of the gang. The White House says it is confident that all of those deported are violent gang members, but the administration has also conceded in legal filings that many do not have criminal records in the U.S. Immigrant advocates contend many are actually not gang members at all, but have been targeted because they have tattoos.
Hmm. The administration has been firm in saying they have the authority to invoke this act. What was the case they made in court?
The Justice Department's lawyer argued that the district court judge overstepped by inserting the court into foreign policy and never should have issued his order in the first place. Here's Drew Ensign from the Justice Department.
The district court's order represents an unprecedented and enormous intrusion upon the powers of the executive branch and in a manner that could intrude upon sensitive diplomatic negotiations.
Ensign also spent a lot of time arguing that immigrant advocates brought basically the wrong kind of lawsuit and should have challenged the individual cases in Texas where these deportation flights originated. We don't know when this panel will rule, but it could be soon.
And at the same time, the Trump administration is fighting to avoid releasing more details about these deportation flights. Where does that stand?
Yeah, on a separate legal track, the Trump administration has told U.S. District Judge James Boasberg last night that it is invoking the state secrets privilege and will continue to not give him key information about those flights, including departure times and other operational details. Boasberg has been pushing the administration to explain whether it defied his orders when it allowed deportation flights to continue last weekend. He has said in court that he will get to the bottom of whether his order was violated.
NPR's Joel Rose. Thank you, Joel.
You're welcome.
Millions around the world are celebrating Nowruz this week. It's a 13-day secular festival, sometimes called Persian New Year. In Syria, it's celebrated mostly by Kurdish people. Many did so in secret until the Assad regime fell in December. Now they're throwing their biggest Nowruz party in decades. And here's Lauren Freyer takes us there.
The traffic on the road to this lake in northern Syria stretches for miles. And then when you get to this turquoise lake surrounded by sort of arid hills, there are people doing conga lines, drum circles, and people playing wooden flutes.
These revelers are Kurdish. They make up about 10% of Syria and live mostly in this northern region, which saw some of the fiercest battles and mass killings of the civil war. Many residents of this city of Afrin fled north to Turkey or east to the protection of Kurdish militias or even to Europe. Shayar Hassan fled to Germany, but he's now come home.
When I was coming and I was on the road, I was taking a video and, you know, my eyes were tearing and talking about 12 years that I haven't been here.
There's one thing, though, that he can't get used to. The presence in the crowd here of Syrian government security forces protecting Kurdish people. This month, the new government signed a peace deal with the biggest Kurdish militia to try to form one united Syrian army. That would have been unthinkable under ex-President Bashar al-Assad, he says.
The time of Bashar al-Assad, we were coming to celebrate Nowruz and the security forces, we would feel terrified. And now it's completely different, so it's very nice.
On Nowruz, people picnic in nature. They cut flowers, light bonfires. Horal Osman is a local Kurdish politician who organized this lakeside gathering. He grew up during the presidency of Bashar's father, Hafez al-Assad, and he remembers being beaten in school for celebrating Nowruz. But it got worse, he says, when hardline Islamist groups took control of this region during Syria's civil war. Some of them considered Nowruz pagan, and they killed four people for celebrating nearby 2 years ago. Those groups are loosely affiliated with the Sunni Arab fighters who now govern Syria. And so Osman says he worries that Syria's new rulers might not always keep their hardline allies in check. Those same groups have been blamed for the killings of other minorities, Alawites, on Syria's coast in recent weeks. Even in grief, you can celebrate just this one happy day, says Siham Alu, a mother of nine children and what she says are too many grandchildren to count. One of them, a little boy, clings to her skirt as Alu describes how decades of repression and conflict have changed her. She says 20 years ago she felt Syrian and Kurdish, but now she's Kurdish first. Lots of other people at this Nowruz celebration say they feel both. But Alu poses a challenge for Syria's new rulers. On top of rebuilding this country and preventing violence from armed groups that are still here, they'll also need to convince this mother of nine to embrace, once again, her Syrian identity. Lauren Freyer, NPR News in Afrin, Syria.
This is NPR News.
Most parenting books don't quite capture what becoming a parent is going to feel like. A new book takes on the madness and the magic of raising children. Next time, here and now.
Appointments get canceled, plans fall through, but NPR is always there with news you can trust live at the top of every hour. Listen on your phone at this station's website or npr.org.
Good morning, I'm Layla Faldin. An octopus with somewhere to be took the fast lane by hopping on a shark. Ecologists spotted the seemingly calm pair off New Zealand and named it Sharktopus. A bright orange Maori octopus curled up right on top of a mako shark's head. It's especially strange because those octopuses live on the seafloor and the sharks don't usually go that deep. Either way, this might require a new baby shark verse. Sharktopus, do-do-do-do. It's morning edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Good morning. Since he took office, President Trump has repeatedly suggested that the U.S. should take over Greenland, a territory controlled by Denmark.
It's in a strategic location, and it is rich in critical minerals used in technology. Here's Trump speaking at a cabinet meeting yesterday.
I think Greenland's going to be something that maybe is in our future. I think it's important. It's important from the standpoint of international security.
But leaders in Greenland and Denmark have repeatedly rejected these advances, saying Greenland is not for sale. So an announcement this week that Second Lady Usha Vance is traveling there raised some eyebrows.
NPR White House correspondent Deepa Shivaram joins us now to talk it through. Hey, Deepa.
Hey, good morning.
Okay, so why is Usha Vance going to Greenland? What is she doing?
Right. So spouses of presidents and vice presidents have typically played a role in facilitating some kind of, you know, soft diplomacy. According to the White House, this is a cultural excursion. Vance will visit historical sites, learn about Greenland's heritage, and attend Greenland's national dog sled race, which involves more than 400 dogs, I learned. But given how fraught things are between the U.S. and Greenland, it's an unusual visit for Vance to make. This early in the administration, it's not clear what Vance's portfolio of issues is and what, you know, she'll focus on. But I did talk to a couple people who've studied first and second ladies, and they were surprised at the announcement of this trip because of how contentious the politics are. Here's Elizabeth Natale. She's a professor at UNC Greensboro and helped found the First Ladies Association of Research and Education.
International travel is often set up as a way for first and second ladies to connect with the voting public or the people of the ally often involved in this travel. When you're promoting friendship, you're promoting equality and humanity and democracy. That is not the context at all as she embarks on this trip later this week.
Now, Natale says it's possible that Vance can carve out a space on this trip to convey a positive image of herself and the U.S. She is bringing one of her young sons with her, but combined with the rhetoric from the White House, it might be a steeper climb for the Second Lady.
Now, is she going on her own, or is there more White House involvement here?
So at this point, there's two parts of this. National Security Advisor Mike Waltz is also making a trip to a U.S. military base in Greenland this week. That's separate. And so Vance is traveling with her son and a U.S. delegation, and they'll be there for about 3 days.
And what's the reaction been in Greenland?
It's been negative. In an interview with a Greenlandic newspaper over the weekend, the prime minister of Greenland said that the visit from members of the Trump administration was very aggressive, Layla. He said that Greenland has to face the seriousness of the situation of the U.S. wanting to annex them. Now, Trump, for his part, says this isn't a provocation. He says it's a purely friendly visit and claimed that the U.S. was invited to visit Greenland, though NPR is not able to confirm if there was an invite. He also mentioned that countries like Russia and China are trying to assert more control in the Arctic region. And he teased that Secretary of State Marco Rubio may also visit the territory. And I will just point out that in January, before inauguration, Trump's son, Donald Trump Jr., made a trip to Greenland as well.
That's NPR's Deepa Shivaram. Thank you, Deepa.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
We're leading with a noted economist who thinks $120,000 a year is a small price to pay to measure the economy in a cutting-edge way.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Amazon Business, committed to business buying solutions to empower leaders to streamline and focus on growth. Learn more about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. New Century Advisors chief economist Claudia Sahm is the one who came up with a closely watched economic indicator that bears her name, the Sahm Rule, Sahm, S-A-H-M. She's been writing that it's a mistake for the administration to pull the plug on an obscure volunteer committee of experts that has been meeting once in a while to make sure that economic measures keep up with the times. And she joins us here. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Federal Economic Statistics Advisory Committee. Now, this sounds like something an anesthesiologist would use to put you to sleep, but it's the committee is going away, and this is actually keeping you awake.
That's right. There's so much uncertainty about the economy, where we're headed, and it is so important that we have the very best data, the very best statistics on the U.S. economy, and that is no small feat. Right, we have a $30 trillion economy. We have 170 million people in the labor force. It's a very dynamic economy, which is super, but that makes it harder to keep the measurement going. And this advisory committee has been in place for many years, and it is a resource to the main economic statistical agencies as a sounding board, as a how could we improve these statistics? What's the best research? And so for me, big picture, we want the best data we can have. And that committee was one resource that we had towards getting those data. And to see that taken away, it's a red flag.
The Commerce Department under the new Trump administration says the work of this committee is done, that its mission is, quote, fulfilled. This is not your view.
The work of a committee that is advising on statistics, how to make them more accurate, how to make them more timely, that work will never be finished. In some of the last meetings of the committee, the statistical agencies came to them with questions about how to measure artificial intelligence. I mean, this is a huge question going forward, and we want to be able to have data that represents all kinds of businesses. So the data either keep up, or we just don't know what's happening. And then that's a really tricky place for anybody who's trying to make a decision, whether it's a household, a business, the government.
And I think I saw the same statistic as you did. This committee costs like $120,000 a year. Its members are not paid. $120,000 may sound like significant money to somebody, but on the grand scheme of the federal government, it's not an expensive item.
$120,000 to get some outside voices, and these are outside independent voices. They're academics, they're people who work in private sector, that have a deep sense of expertise. So it's also about transparency. Like, it's great to have some outside eyes on what's happening in these statistical agencies. So it really shows a very short-sighted view of the economic statistics and the kinds of investments that need to be made in them.
I'm hearing you say that less transparency implied by turning off this committee, less transparency would have its own cost.
Absolutely. We need high quality statistics so that people trust the data. This committee, these are people who are really experts. I mean, just love the nitty gritty of the data. So if something were happening, if the data were being manipulated, they're the kind of experts that would notice. The statistics aren't being manipulated. I'm not saying that's an intention of this administration at all. But having a committee, having outsiders who are knowledgeable about what's happening in the agencies, that's a great way to make sure manipulation doesn't happen. Because once you lose trust, it is so hard to gain it back. Like, why would we risk that?
Claudia Sahm, chief economist at New Century Advisors, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, Dr. Sahm came up with a way to track in real time whether we're in a recession. It's about the unemployment rate rising from a low, and you can look it up on a Federal Reserve website, like an electrocardiogram of the economy. So, Claudia Sahm of Sahm Rule fame, are we now in a recession?
We are not in a recession right now.
Okay, but there is news just now that consumer expectations about the future dropped to the lowest level in 12 years, given all the uncertainty over policy, including tariffs and inflation and talk of a slowdown. Stocks, the Dow up 78 points, 2/10%. S&P up 3/10%. The NASDAQ now up 4/10%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Commvault. When companies face ransomware and outages, they can recover data and business in just minutes with Commvault.
The lowest paid workers in America saw the fastest wage growth over the last 5 years. That's from fresh data from the Economic Policy Institute. Now, adjusted for inflation, the bottom 10% of workers saw their pay go up more than 15% between 2019 and 2024. Marketplace's Samantha Field has more.
This time 5 years ago, between February and April 2020, about 22 million people lost their jobs, many of them low-wage workers.
Workers in leisure and hospitality and retail, right? All of those industries were essentially shut down.
Elise Gould at the Economic Policy Institute says when things reopened and employers started hiring again,
workers had a moment to pause, right? We had one time in history better unemployment insurance programs, and they could be a little bit choosier.
Which meant employers had to pay more. This happened across the economy, for those in higher paying jobs too, just not quite as much. Their wages have risen about 6 or 7% since 2019, compared to 15% for people in the lowest paying jobs.
It's also 15% starting from a very low base. If you're making $10 an hour, 15% growth is $1.50.
Brad Hirschbein at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research says even with that jump in wages, many of the lowest paid workers are still struggling, and inflation has hit them particularly hard.
They tend to buy things that are more subject to inflation, and those things also represent a larger share of all the things that they buy. Take rent, for example. We know that rent is a bigger share of people's budget at the bottom than at the top.
And rent has gone way up in the last 5 years, which, he says, has eaten into those wage gains. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
And the city council in San Diego has taken a step toward making supermarkets offer in-store coupons, same as digital, to help seniors and others who don't or can't do online. But the Grocers Association says it's unworkable and that it is not unfair to offer the best customers the best deals. Our producers are Ariana Rosas, Alex Schroeder, and Erica Soderstrom. Our senior producer is Meredith Gerritsen-Morby. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.